From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Hampton Sides' book is about an expedition in 1879 aboard a ship, the USS Jeannette, to get to the top of the world. Sides says at the time, the North Pole was a mystery, and really, no one knew what was up there, whether it was ice or land, whether it was desolate or inhabited. And there was a big question about whether it was even cold in the North Pole, because there was this theory that if you could just break through a ring of ice, you would make your way into a warm and open polar sea. The trick was to find the gap in the ice, and that's what the expedition of the USS Jeannette was all about. Hampton Sides is joining us today to talk about this story. It's a story of survival and madness and love, too. It's called The Kingdom of Ice, after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So here's the idea that kept a young naval officer named George Washington DeLong up at night in the 1870s. He wanted to find a gap in the ice far north around the 80th parallel that would lead to an open polar sea. There was a theory at the time that if you could just get past this belt of ice, this barrier, you would find open water, relatively warm open water, people thought, and then you'd have a straight shot to the North Pole. This is the story the writer Hampton Sides tells in his new book called The Kingdom of Ice. It's about DeLong's determination to get to the North Pole, and we're not going to give it all away, this story, but suffice it to say it's an epic tale about survival in one of the world's most forbidding places. And like all good stories, it has great characters and stalwart heroic types and eccentric crazy types. And there's a love story in here, too. Hampton Sides is joining us today to talk about his book called In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. And he's joining us today from a studio in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And Hampton Sides, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. A pleasure being back with you.
Well, it's interesting. This is such an American story, but you found it when you were in Norway. I find that kind of interesting.
Yeah, kind of a circuitous way of finding a story. But I was doing a piece for National Geographic magazine in Oslo, and it was about a Norwegian explorer named Fridtjof Nansen, an amazing polar explorer in his own right, who about 20 years after the voyage of the USS Jeannette tried to duplicate this American voyage in a differently designed vessel. And I thought it was interesting that he kept mentioning it all over this museum in Oslo. There's mentionings of the Jeannette and George Washington DeLong, this American who I'd never heard of. And, you know, I work for Outside Magazine. I write for National Geographic. I read these kinds of tales. And I'd never heard of it. No one I asked had ever heard of it. So I dug into it and realized that there was this great American Gilded Age adventure story that had sort of fallen between the cracks of history.
How does it work that when you sort of decide to – I mean, you spent something like 4 years on this book.
Yeah, so how does it, plus anyway.
Yeah. So when you are deciding that you're going to commit this much time to a project like this, I mean, what was the clincher for you? I mean, yes, it was a good story, but I guess as you started to sort of unpeel all the layers, you found all of the elements that would make for something that was worth spending so much time on, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole process by which I pick my books is something that's still kind of mysterious to me. It's got a rational aspect and it's got an irrational aspect, a kind of a feeling, a hunch. And I certainly got that hunch with this one as soon as I heard about it. It literally kind of like tingles down my spine, you know, like this is a great tale. These characters are so strong. And yet, you know, the fact that no one had heard of it, the fact that reasonably well-read people versed in Arctic literature had never heard of it, was perhaps the clincher, as you say. That and also the existence of a lot of primary material. That's always important with these kinds of stories, diaries, testimony, books that were written after the fact, and that sort of thing. And this has almost an embarrassment of of primary material. So it kind of had all the qualities that that I like to have in a book.
What's great about it, too, is a lot of, and we'll talk about this as we go along, but a lot of the characters were decent writers. That must have helped a lot, yeah. too.
Yeah, you know, part of it, I think, was generational. People yeah. took the time to sit down and write thoughtful letters and after action reports and things like that. But also just the quality of the diction and the quality of the writing. This is also true of the Civil War era. This story is just after the Civil War. Mm-hmm. But you get that quality of just eloquence and elegance with the written word that I think is sorely lacking in our generation.
Well, let's talk about the principal character, certainly one of them anyways, and that's George Washington DeLong. And mm-hmm. You begin in the book telling about he's pretty young at this point, second in command of this ship called the Little Juniata. Is that how it's pronounced?
Yes, that's right.
And it's this ship that's dispatched to search for the survivors of this expedition up north.
Mm-hmm. A previous one.
A previous yeah. one. The Polaris it was, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, this is something that, you know, is a quality of the Arctic that, you know, it's just this – there seems to be endless number of vessels that are sent north and then other vessels that are sent north to look for the original vessel.
Right.
And then, you know, a third wave to look for the first wave. And, you know, it's like we never learn from these Arctic tales. The things go wrong. People go north and everything goes south. And this is how DeLong came into the story of the Arctic. He was on the Little Juniata and he was heading north and he was trying to find evidence or any kind of tidings of this previous vessel that had run into such hardship. But counterintuitively, instead of this being a forbidding tale for him, he was captivated by the mm-hmm. Arctic and was lured by it. And really it became an addiction of his. And he spent the rest of his life trying to get to the North Pole.
It's funny because you mentioned when he first encountered the cold, barren landscapes. I mean, he had been all over the world, seen a lot of the tropics, for example, hadn't seen a lot of the forbidding part of the north yet. And he said he didn't really think much of it at first. But as you say, the further he pressed north, something began to take hold of him. And there's this story you tell when he arrives back home and his beloved wife, Emma, you say instantly noticed something different about him. It is as though he had contracted a fever. What was she seeing in him?
Well, this is something that seems to happen with certain people in the Arctic. Either you love it or you hate it. And he literally, this was an obsession of his at this point. He fell in love with the grandeur of this immense wilderness with the, you know, certain atmospheric phenomena in the Arctic, the way sound travels over the ice, you know, obviously it's a very raw and very stark kind of beauty, but he found it to be so compelling that he wanted to devote the rest of his life to this puzzle of finding out what was. And this is sort of the intellectual aspect of it and the pure exploratory aspect of it is, you know, what is at the top of the world?
Yeah.
It's almost impossible for us now to recall or to appreciate how obsessed people were with this question. It was a nagging, gnawing enigma, a riddle that, you know, and there was only a few places left on the planet that had never been touched by man. Mm. But the North Pole was the prime target, the prime goal. And so much blood and treasure and energy and effort went into solving this enormous riddle. And he was just sucked in completely on that trip to Greenland.
We'll talk a little bit more about your own trips to this region as we go. But having said that you yourself went to a lot of these places, you traced
yeah.
the steps here. Do you relate to that? Not obsession, maybe, but that
yeah.
kind of affection for that place.
There were days where I really felt it. And one of the things that was amazing to me, when I went up past the Bering Strait, we went up to this place called Wrangel Island, which is off the northeast coast of Siberia. And we rammed through a lot of ice. And thank God it was an icebreaker. It was a Russian icebreaker that we were on. But I kind of had this notion that once you're stuck in the ice as so many of these Arctic tales become really the tale of being stuck in the ice. I always thought it was kind of this monolithic slab that you were just sort of stuck in there and imprisoned, and that was it. But what I sensed was how alive the ice is, how it's constantly moving. There's so many different types and shapes and colors of ice, all in constant chaos and turmoil. And there's the shrieking sounds and sighing sounds and shuddering of the ice. It's constantly moving, churning life force out there. And I can see how, although it can be terrifically frightening, it can also be, in this haunting sort of way, addictive. And the men, so many of the men on this voyage had been veterans of previous Arctic voyage. They not only did they have the experience, but they just had this obsession, this kind of polar fever that Emma was talking about.
There's this characteristic that I think puts everything into context, and it's the characteristic of the time. One of these is the fact that, as you say, this happened, this plays out in the years after the Civil War. And this was, you've described the generation, George Washington DeLong being among them, as a kind of stoic generation that had missed, I guess it was the glory of the Civil War, and they were looking for something grand for their own lives, I guess.
Yeah, well, that was certainly an aspect for DeLong himself. He missed the Civil War literally by a matter of months. He graduated from the Naval Academy in 65. And so he and some of his colleagues had this kind of chip on their shoulder in a way that they had missed this momentous chapter in American history, that their brothers and fathers and uncles had fought on battlefields. What were we going to do? What was our generation going to accomplish? And so one thing that they could do is try to solve this planetary enigma and do it for their nation, do it for their Navy, and also for personal glory. The United States, having emerged from the devastation of the Civil War, was just beginning to flex its muscles on the world stage and to compete with the different powers. Up to this point, almost all of the polar exploration had been undertaken by the British or the Russians or Scandinavian nations. We were just entering this game, and we had the ambitions and we had the innovative spirit. The Navy, however, was rather anemic didn't have the money to really foot the bill for this. So what you ended up with is this kind of unorthodox hybrid structure of a U.S. Navy expedition that was completely paid for by a private citizen.
Yeah, yeah. A fascinating private citizen who I want to get to,
yes,
too, in a minute, too, because there are a lot of great stories just with him.
Yeah. Yeah.
But just in terms of the context of the time, we should also say, as you say in the book, explain in the book, 1876, for example, and this is when DeLong is ruminating about this voyage that he wants to put together. I mean, this was a time when you have, of course, Thomas Edison and you have Alexander Graham Bell, and they're starting to innovate, their remarkable inventions. You have the introduction of ketchup, and you have the introduction of root beer, and the emergence of this mysterious tropical fruit called the banana. I mean, it's like we're coming into not the modern time, but it was a pretty remarkable time.
Right. And it all kind of came together there at the Centennial Exposition in a World's Fair that was held in Philadelphia. And it was, just all these inventions from all these different rooms and this giant campus of buildings. And the United States really shined, outshone all the other nations when it came to innovation at that time. Everyone, the British observers and visitors and the German visitors, all said, "What's going on with America? They're just cranking out more patents than they know what to do with." And all these amazing inventions were on display in that exposition, including the telephone. And some of the polar thinkers, some of the real important theorists and map makers of the North Country went to that exposition and were captivated by the energy that was on display there. And it seemed to them that the United States was emerging as the power that was actually going to reach the North Pole.
It's interesting that the voyage of the Polaris, which, again, this lesson that they keep getting but never quite learning. You should you mentioned it should have served as this cautionary tale for
right.
for DeLong, but really it didn't. I mean, he wants to go back there, and so of course, as you say, he has to put together the resources. The Navy doesn't have them, so he has to seek out a private individual, which brings up this eccentric man named James Gordon Bennett. He figures he's going to be the man to finance this idea. Let's talk about him, because he's a bookend of himself.
Yeah, he is. And he almost at various times during the project threatened to overshadow everything else, because he's just this gift that keeps on giving in terms of narrative. Gordon Bennett was this hugely spoiled brat of the Gilded Age who inherited the New York Herald, which was then the largest newspaper in the world. He was said to be the third richest man in Manhattan. And he was an adventurer himself, a sportsman, a yachtsman. He won the first transatlantic yacht race. Mm-hmm. He was the youngest ever commodore of the New York Yacht Club. What else? He was a speed walker.
Yeah,
you know, just because why not? You know, he also was known as the naked coachman, because he would stage these races at midnight around Manhattan in the raw, these coach races that are extremely dangerous, actually, and people would see this crazed guy on his coach, just, you know,
in the buff,
just naked as a jailbird. What else? He urinated publicly into a grand piano at a salon party of his fiancée's family, and this got him thrown out on the streets and flogged, and then he challenged this his opposition to a duel.
This was his fiance or prospective fiance's brother who was trying to
brother.
Yeah,
and you know, so ultimately though he found him that he needed to leave the United States. Dueling was illegal, and so he just took off, went to Paris, and created his whole universe there, and ran his New York newspaper via the transatlantic cables from Paris. Yeah. He also, I mean, he wasn't really into owls. He had stuffed owls and living owls and owls on all of his emblems. He had hundreds of Pomeranians, which he thought were quite wise. But the other thing about Bennett, though, these are all his eccentricities, but he was a brilliant, in his own way, a very brilliant publisher, and had a fascination for invention and for exploration. He had sent Stanley to find Livingston in Africa, and that series of dispatches was such a hit that he was looking for an encore to that, something that would be even bigger. And so he was very receptive to the idea of bankrolling an expedition to the North Pole, and had his own theories about what might be up there. And he was particularly captivated by the ideas of this man named Dr. August Petermann, who is a German map maker, maker really of the best maps in the world at that time, who also had a lot of really kind of crazy theories about what might be up there. We'd say crazy now. Back then, they were kind of the cutting edge theories. Mm-hmm. And as you alluded to in your introduction, one of those theories was the open polar sea. This old idea going back to the Vikings and the Greeks that, you know, that there is somewhere beyond the ice a place of eternal sunshine and even summer and tropical waters. And it's just amazing how an idea, a myth like this gets started, and how difficult it is to dislodge it from the public imagination. And so Bennett was interested in testing this theory and bankrolling an expedition to head to the north to see if there was still any merit in the open polar sea.
You know, you'd mentioned around this time it was Jules Verne who had written his fantasy novel Journey to the Center of the Earth, which was based, you point out, on this idea that the earth, you know, was hollow and the vents – mm-hmm. You know, we're shooting through the poles, so I guess it would make sense if you sort of had that kind of theory that it might be warm up there.
Yeah, yeah, and not only that, but we were beginning to learn about the immense power of the Gulf Stream, this Atlantic current that, you know, goes from the tropics north past Norway and heads generally in the direction of the North Pole. One of the leading theories was that it tunneled under the ice and went all the way to the to the pole, where it was joined by another current. There's a kind of a symmetrical current on the other side of the planet called the Kuroshio in the Pacific Ocean that does much the same thing. And people thought that it went through the Bering Strait and tunneled under the ice, and that these two great currents met at the North Pole, and thus explaining the open polar sea. And, you know, it was kind of this grandiose and sort of a beautiful, symmetrical thermoregulation system that the planet supposedly had. Like, just like as a human being has a circulatory system, so the planet did too. Mm-hmm. And this was a theory anyway. And you know, it would only take a German scientist like this guy, August Petermann, to dream up something like this in a way that would captivate people around the world. But it was one of the leading theories at the time.
Hampton Sides is with us. His book is called In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. We'll take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Hampton Sides is joining us to talk about his book, In the Kingdom of Ice. It's an epic survival story, really, plays out in one of the world's most unforgiving regions, bankrolled by a rich, eccentric brat. It involves madness and starvation. There's a love story in here, too. Well, as I said there in the introduction, yes, it's about this adventure, but it is about love. Did that surprise you, the fact that this would be a love story too?
Well, yes. It seems like most of the stories, the books that I've written have been these kind of two-fisted He-Man adventure stories, war stories. I've never had a love story running through any of my books, really. But this one called out to itself almost kind of organically during the research phase of the project, because early on I had one of those experiences I think that all historians dream about, but it rarely comes to pass, which is this idea of tracking down a distant relation of your subject, your historical subject. And they say, oh, you know, interesting that you called, because I have this trunk
in
full
the attic
of old letters in the attic,
yeah,
in the proverbial attic. And in this case, she really did. It was a woman named Catherine DeLong in Connecticut who had this trunk full of letters that she didn't know what to do with. Please come, she said, and take them off my hands. And I flew immediately to Connecticut and began to sift through this material. And it was the personal papers of Emma DeLong,
right,
George DeLong's wife, who was a great writer, who saved everything, lived a long life, and had just amazing materials, including all of her early love letters to and from her husband, and then letters that she wrote during the expedition, during the summer of 1880 and 1881, that she wrote to her husband. She called them her letters to nowhere,
yeah,
because she didn't know if they would ever reach him. But she had them sent north on these Arctic whaling vessels in the hope that somehow, some way they would get to him. And they're just beautiful letters. They start out kind of matter of fact, and then become a little bit more searching, a little more desperate. And then by the end of the story, they are just heartbreaking in their anguish and their despair as she's wondering, where is her husband and where are the men of the USS Jeannette?
Mm-hmm.
So they ended up being an important part of the story, kind of the last third. They are kind of the emotional spine of the story. And it ends up being quite a love story.
Yeah. George DeLong is such an interesting guy because it seems like there's this paradox going on in some way. I mean, on one hand, he is romantic, but he's also pretty stoic. You know, he's a military man after all, confined himself. This is how you put it, mm-hmm, in the book, confined himself to a straitjacket of discipline.
Right.
But then, of course, he's a man of the Navy, he's a man of the military, but he also hated the hierarchy part, the politics part, the rules part, and seemed like such a romantic. He was a really interesting guy.
Yeah, a lot of contradictions. And, You know, I think that he found that polar exploration was one way for him to win a name for himself and some glory for himself, but also to kind of short circuit a lot of the hierarchy of the Navy. Not everyone in the Navy wanted to go this kind of course. This was kind of an unorthodox path. So it gave him a command of a ship, but it enabled him to fill all these dreams he had, all this wanderlust and all this kind of sense of romance. I think there were a number of people high up in the hierarchy of the Navy who were a little jealous of him or just didn't understand who this sort of upstart was. He was quite young. He had made a name for himself in Greenland and fallen in love with the Arctic and suddenly he was, you know, on the covers of on the page one of all these newspapers, and he was quite a celebrity. And when the men of the Jeannette left San Francisco in the summer of 1879, I mean, he was a household name. Everybody knew George DeLong and his men. They were like astronauts being sent off to the dark side of the moon or something. And I think some of the Navy cast aspersions on him. There's certainly a sense that with a lot of these Arctic explorers, you really sense that they're really just glory hounds. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure you can say that about DeLong. He's a complicated cat. Yeah. There's a lot of motivations there. But like you say, very romantic at the same time. I mean, here's this guy who has this sense of naval discipline that's just rock bed. I mean, he was brutal. You did not disobey his orders on ship. But at night, he's writing these unbelievable love letters to his wife that are, you know, at times almost sickly sweet. You know, they're so saccharine. They're so, he's missing her so much. Interesting contradictions in his personality.
One of the characters, of course, of the book is the Jeannette itself, used to be called the Pandora. And as you describe this ship, not terribly sleek, not terribly fast, but it was – and it was pretty small. But it was staunch. I mean, I don't know. It seems like a character to me in the book.
Yeah. Well, I tried to make it a kind of a character. It's a little dowdy. You know, it's a little rough around the edges. It was originally built as a British gunship, but it then became used as an exploring yacht in Greenland, in the Arctic, by the British, and had fared quite well, and withstood a lot of that, you know, the pressure of the ice pack. But when Gordon Bennett bought the boat and renamed it the Jeannette after his sister, he and also the naval engineers took a look at it and said, you know, we need to make it stronger. And they proceeded to practically rebuild it from the inside out to reinforce it for the enormous pressures that they knew they would be encountering north of the Bering Strait.
You know, one thing I noticed about the Jeannette is in the early days, but this was before they made it, because they had to sail the ship around the Horn to San Francisco to get it prepared, as you say, for the expedition. Bennett has renamed the ship, which if you're a sailor, that's a terrible idea. That's a horrible superstition.
It's bad luck.
Bad luck, tempting fate. Augustus Peterman, as you mentioned, who's the guiding spirit of the expedition, kills himself in 1870.
Commits suicide.
The Jeannette goes through this massive tropical storm, almost sinks on its way to San Francisco. Dannenhauer, one of the people, confesses to a bout of melancholy. He's got this pretty remarkable story that he doesn't tell anyone. And we can talk about any of these in the particular, but I'm just thinking of all of these things that are going on before the expedition even gets started. They're all terrible omens, it seems.
Yes, I know. And certainly that was something that struck me is the element of tragedy here that, you know, it seems like, you know, tragedies unfold and often in these ways with, you know, just a near miss here and an almost there and a bad omen there. But, you know, that we as the reader can certainly see it as a bad omen. But the protagonist stuck in the story is not viewing it that way. They enter into this tragedy with their eyes wide open and they seem to ignore all these bad signs. And there's so many other ones too. For example, as they're heading north into the Bering Strait, another vessel is coming back that same summer with knowledge, having studied the currents and the temperatures of the ocean, that there wasn't a warm water current going north through the Bering Strait. There was not going to be this gateway to the open polar sea. And, you know, the whole expedition was based on fatuous science. And, you know, if they had the benefit of the knowledge of this, what this geodetic survey vessel had, and they missed it just by a matter of months, they would have completely rethought their expedition. So it's an accumulation of these little errors and almosts and what ifs, and you know that it's almost like the definition of a tragedy in a way. It's not any one thing. It's this accumulation of things.
Yeah. Tell us about the crew. These were people. It's interesting when he was looking for a crew, they got applications. You say from pretty much everywhere. Everyone wanted this job.
Yeah, I mean, you might ask, why would thousands of people apply for a job that is virtually guaranteed to end up in hardship, horrible diet, and probable death?
Yeah.
And yet, yes, thousands applied. Everybody wanted to be a part of this. It, you know, it's partly, you know, this was one of the great gallant missions. Like I said earlier about these were many people who had just missed the Civil War, and there weren't any wars to fight exactly. This was one of the great things that you could do and make a name for yourself and solve some riddles and help science along the way and help your country. Also, another thing is we had fairly recently purchased Alaska from the Russians, and there was a lot of curiosity about what was north of our new acquisition, our new territory. And here was the very first time that anyone had attempted to reach the North Pole by any means, by going in that direction through the Bering Strait north of Alaska. It had always up to that point been around Norway or around Greenland. So this was a new route. This was a part of the world that had never before been seen by man. And the crew that emerged from this application process was really quite an interesting cross-section of Gilded Age America. There were there were two scientists on board, a meteorologist and a naturalist who came from the Smithsonian. There was an ice pilot who was essentially an Arctic whaler who had spent his whole life in and around the ice and knew the behavior of the ice extremely well. There was a surgeon, and believe me, the surgeon gets to test his abilities to the hilt. I mean, this is, you know, everything goes wrong at some point or another during this expedition. The surgeon's name is Ambler, and he sees it all. There's Dannenhauer, who you mentioned earlier, the navigator, who ultimately we find out has syphilis, and his syphilis ultimately manifests itself in the form of this condition called syphilitic iritis. It's an enormous pain in his eyes that requires that he undergo multiple operations without anesthesia down in the bottom of the ship, can't tolerate any kind of light. Mm-hmm. So you have a blind navigator. You have this meteorologist who's from Ireland, who is an amazing man. Collins is his name, Jerome Collins. The only problem with Collins is that he's a punster. He's constantly, constantly delivering puns and limericks and bad jokes. And it's you know, you've been around people like that. It's fun for a day or two.
Yeah.
We're talking 2 years because they get locked in the ice and they get stuck there for 2 years drifting slowly but surely in the direction of the North Pole. But they're not, you know, you can just imagine what someone who's delivering puns every day, how many people wanted to wring his neck by the end of this.
It's Hampton Sides. His book is In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. And we need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. I'm Katie Lear. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer Hampton Sides. We're talking about his book, In the Kingdom of Ice. It's the extraordinary story of the USS Jeannette and this amazing expedition north. We should mention, Hampton Sides, just quickly that so we're talking a lot about this first part of the book. The second part of the book, we want to be careful. We don't want to give too much away. It's pretty remarkable. But the second part of the book is the one about survival. So as you mentioned, by, I guess it's New Year's Eve of 1880, they'd been trapped in the pack ice for 16 months at that point, had drifted 1,300 miles, which, by the way, as you point out, was far enough to reach the North Pole and go, you know, further beyond all of that. But you get a sense that in some ways the boredom must have been enough to absolutely, and I guess in some ways that probably did drive some of them a little bit crazy, but the boredom must have been unbelievable.
Sure, it was. And DeLong tried to do everything he could to combat that. I mean, he had them out playing football out on the ice and hunting every day and exercising every day. And they all had hourly tasks that they had to do in terms of collecting data, weather data and descriptions of the ice and scientific logs of all sorts. But eventually the sameness, the monotony, the monochrome quality of just being in the ice, drifting kind of haplessly, you know, forward, backward. Sometimes they'd circle back to where they were 2 months ago, that kind of thing, because the pack is constantly moving, but not in a straight line. It was driving them all slowly mad. When finally the pack did crush the hull of the ship and the Jeannette sank to the bottom of the Arctic Ocean. And DeLong and his 33 men and their 40 dogs are out there. But he had organized it quite well. He knew it was coming and he had rehearsed what to do in this situation. They got their essential belongings in their three open boats and decided that what they had to do was try to make it to the nearest landmass, which was the central Arctic coast of Siberia. Which is about 1,000 miles away, dragging these boats. They're just essentially like mules in harness, pulling their stuff across the ice until they reach open water and head for Siberia.
So I love the way you tell the story of the day the Jeannette finally sinks. Because it's a pretty amazing story. I mean, in January, the ship in some way starts to sink, really.
Right.
And there's another terrific character in the book, Melville.
Yeah, George Melville.
Mm-hmm. He becomes a pretty central figure, of course, in the story.
Major character, yes.
Yeah, and he comes up with this, I have to say, it sounds like an amazing kind of jury-rigged system, this windmill system to get the water out because it starts sinking in January.
Yeah, just one example of Melville's genius. I mean, he is kind of like the Odysseus or you know, this crafty, wily guy who can fix anything and get out of any kind of scrape. And DeLong increasingly has to rely on Melville, who is said to be a distant relative of Herman Melville. He's a engineer. He goes on after the expedition to become ultimately the chief engineer of the entire U.S. Navy and a rear admiral. So, I mean, this is a substantial guy. He also wrote a beautiful account of the Jeannette expedition. So he becomes a major character both in terms of what he did and then what he said about it afterwards.
Yeah.
But, he comes up with this windmill system for pumping the water out and keeping the Jeannette afloat. But eventually, you know, the pressure is just too much.
Yeah, and can't take it.
Even though they've massively reinforced this hull for the ice, it can't last forever. And when it sinks, you know, it just it's an interesting thing because it briefly there's an opening in the ice and suddenly, for the first time in 2 years,
it floats.
Jeannette is floating.
Yeah,
yeah. Just floating like, you know, like it's supposed to in this lagoon. And it seems to be not leaking anymore. And there's this moment of hopefulness. And then suddenly it springs other leaks. Two different pieces of the ice come together almost like in a pincer movement and just stabs the thing in its vitals. And it sinks very rapidly after that. And they only have maybe 10 minutes to get their belongings out on the ice.
Gosh.
And so they do. No one dies in this. in this part of the story, they get on the ice, they organize their stuff in a military fashion, and they begin this great retreat across the ice, which I really feel is one of the great survival stories, one of the great endurance stories of all time. It's the American Shackleton, you know, 35 years before the endurance.
This is 90. We're talking 91 days too.
Yes, it takes them 91 days to finally reach open water and put their whaleboats into the water, only to find out that having dragged those boats for all those days across the ice, these boats are not seaworthy. Mm-hmm. They can't float. So enter Melville again and his carpenters, and they patch these boats together with whalebone, walrus bone, driftwood, anything they can find, and somehow amazingly get these boats working in working order again.
Yeah.
And they set sail for Siberia.
I think one of the most I'm not sure how much you want to talk about this or can, but there is a moment during this 91-day progression where they realize that they were not going forward, they were going backward.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
It seems like one of the most heartbreaking moments in the story.
Yeah,
almost.
It's a sort of Sisyphean effort kind of thing. They really struggled extremely hard this one particular 10-day period where they really thought they were making great progress. And they were so proud of themselves and the way they pulled together as a team. And they're moving – they felt they had moved at least 50 miles, maybe 100 – closer to 100 miles to the south. But then they took a positional reading and found out that the ice over which they were traveling was drifting faster and farther towards the north than they were going south.
Mm.
So that effectively they were indeed going backwards. And it was just such a low moment. I mean, they were in just such utter despair at that point because it just seemed like they couldn't win for losing and
yeah.
they couldn't fight these elements, which were so much greater than they were.
You know, I want to play a clip from an Orson Welles Mercury Theater broadcast. This was from 1938. And what's so interesting about this clip is so a couple of years ago, you go to Oslo, Norway. You hear about this story. You had no idea. Most Americans have no clue about the Jeanette. Back in 1938,
yeah.
people actually did know about this. At least Orson Welles did.
Yeah, I think that was the last time that it really entered the whole national consciousness was in 1938. There was a book called Hell on Ice, which was a novel.
Yeah.
And it was told from the point of view of Melville, this great character and this great strong character. And Orson Welles became so taken with it that he did one of those amazing radio productions of it, sort of like War of the Worlds, that was a national broadcast. And he said it was really the last time that Jeanette was part of our sort of shorthand, national shorthand of adventure stories.
Let's play a clip from it because it's quite great. And this is one of those – this is the moment really at the end of that 91-day struggle. Here's a clip from the Orson Welles broadcast, Hell on Ice.
For 91 days, we struggled on over the ice going southwest, now towards the Lena Delta, through fog day after day, ferrying across leads, pulling through slush our clothes, constantly soaked in ice water. The most we covered in one day was 6 miles, some days not more than two. The men growing weaker every day from frostbite and scurvy. On September 9th, 91 days after the sinking of the Jeanette, we reached the edge of the ice in the open sea. Crawled into camp and then DeLong mustered his crew, called the roll. That night he held divine service. Even the sick joined in. Only Collins stayed in his tent.
Thank God for thy mercies. We pray thee for deliverance to our homes and to thy continued service. Amen. Eternal Father, strong to save.
It's great. It's such a great...
Doesn't make you want to kind of work on your radio delivery a little bit?
It kind of does.
Go a little Orson Welles?
It's true. Collins, well, of course, the reference who stays in his tent in that little clip there. He's the punster, of course.
Yeah, by that, at a certain point, everyone got so tired of his puns and they just, you know, they just told him to just cut it out. And so he got to be quite, you know, he became very withdrawn, you know, it's like. And he also began to tangle with Melville. Inevitably, of course, there were some personality clashes and some disobedience issues. And, of course, DeLong's always worrying about mutiny, the possibility of mutiny of some sort. And he keeps a lid on it. But the closest he comes to seeing some kind of mutiny is with Collins. So, you know, there's some personality dynamics at work here.
Yeah. We should say dogs play kind of a central part in this adventure.
Yeah. Now, you know, I will say that this is probably not a book that the SPCA will like particularly. Yeah. You know, in these Arctic stories, the dogs suffer horribly. And I don't mean that they're eaten, because DeLong does not allow that until the very, very end, when there may or may not be a little of that. I won't go into the details. But no, the dogs get lost. They get on ice floes and drift off. Other dogs fight with each other and get killed. Some die from exhaustion. Some die from starvation. But everybody has a favorite dog. The dogs are, you know, constant and close companions and become a real vital part of the story.
So James Gordon Bennett, he gets what he's looking for. Now, he doesn't obviously get a warm polar sea. He doesn't get that confirmed, but he was after the scoop, and he certainly got that in spades, I guess.
He did, and then some. I mean, more so than really Stanley Livingston, in the sense of the number of stories that this thing generated. Because not only do you have the story of the Jeannette expedition itself, but numerous vessels that were sent north to look for the Jeannette also went north and got into their own kinds of trouble. And, you know, just that same phenomenon I was speaking of earlier, just like more and more vessels going to find the original vessel that was lost. Do we never learn from these things? You know, also along the way, three islands were discovered. A big swath of the Arctic was explored that had never been seen before by man. A lot of discoveries were made kind of in the negative, in the sense that they proved that there wasn't a thermometric gateway that led to an open polar sea. They proved that this place called Wrangell wasn't a continent, which was one of the theories at the time, that it was just a small island. It was an expedition that actually yielded a lot of information, a lot of knowledge, a lot of discovery. So it was a success in that sense. Not everyone made it home, however. And I hesitate to talk about the last 100 pages or so of the book, because I've found that, you know, readers have said that it's just a lot more powerful if they don't know.
Yeah.
And most readers go along with it, in the sense that obviously you can get online and Google it. It's an obscure expedition, but not that obscure. You can find out if you really want to. But resist the urge, because it's a lot better. It's a lot more interesting and I think a lot more moving if you don't know.
You, as we mentioned earlier on, you traveled to some of these places. You went to the Lena Delta. You went to a place called American Mountain. You went to Wrangell Island. Give us a sense of what that was like, knowing the context of it. You know, being there. You said that Wrangell Island in some ways seemed kind of magical. I mean, it was the last place on Earth where the mammoths were, for example.
Right. Well, you know, I think with these kinds of narrative histories that I write, I find that it's really important to go physically to the places that I'm writing about whenever possible. And because of the retreating of the ice and because of the end of the Cold War, You know, it was increasingly possible to go to a lot of these places that the Jeanette went to and to get a feel for that terrain. Turned out to be a brief window, though. When I went, which was in the summer of 2012, our relationship with Russia was pretty good.
Yeah.
Now, I honestly believe that the trips that I made, which some of which were into these restricted military zones, I think that trip would not be possible. All the permits that you have to get and so forth, since Putin invaded Crimea and so mm-hmm. forth, where, you know, our relationship has deteriorated. So that in retrospect, I realize that I was fairly lucky in terms of finding this little window with which to do a trip like this. But yeah, Wrangel Island, that is an amazing place. It's been called the Galapagos of the High North. It's the world's largest denning ground for polar bears. There's giant walrus and snow geese and snowy owl populations, Arctic fox. And it's just an amazing place, a restricted nature preserve way up there, way above the Arctic Circle.
Let me ask you that. We've got about a minute left. One of the guiding questions for you early on was this idea of whether or not you figured our generation or your generation could make it through something like that. Did you come to any conclusions about whether we were tough enough to make something like this?
Well, it's certainly something I asked myself the whole time I was writing the book. It was like, would I have survived this?
Yeah.
And if so, how? What qualities would I have been able to summon to get through this thing? Because it becomes this horrific ordeal, this story of them getting back. And, you know, faith, physical stamina, stoicism, sense of humor, whatever kinds of qualities you can summon. And, you know, I do think we're a softer generation. We're certainly not knowing what we know now about something like what's up at the top of the world. We know that there's just a shifting carapace of ice up there. There's not any great warm water sea or islands or continents or anything, we probably wouldn't go. But back then, that urge to explore was so basic, so elemental. It's such a big part of the human instinct that I think it was almost inevitable. They had to go.
Hampton Sides. His book is In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeanette. Hampton, thanks very much.
Pleasure being with you.
Radio West is a production of KUVR News, the show produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.